Welcome to the Bill Kelly Podcast. I'm Bill Kelly. While the COVID-19 crisis offers us an opportunity to create a better normal in Canadian long-term care facilities, Dr. Pat Armstrong joins us to discuss that. Ontario are going to expand its big box retail blitz amid widespread COVID-19 rule violations. Labour Minister Monty McNaughton joins us to give us the details. And we discuss the conflicts of medicine, how they affect patient safety and health. Why are they wrong and how are they being concealed? And what can we do about it? It's all coming up. The Bill Kelly Podcast starts now.
Today on The Bill Kelly Show on 900 CHML.
We're going to spend some time talking about long-term care facilities once again, because there is so much misinformation. We're getting inundated with reports back and forth about what's good, what's bad, and the level of care really is somewhat problematic. And one of the concerns here is the mixed messages we're getting from the government and even from some researchers. And we're going to get into a couple of elements about how that actually works out. A constant guest that we've had on the program many times to talk about this, Dr. Vivian Stamatopoulos, of course, says the ministry is not really in tune with what's really happening in long-term care facilities.
This is a tipping point. We are at the crisis point, and it doesn't help that we have a minister of long-term care who tries to put out this false image that everything is stable and everything is okay when everybody on the ground floor, all the experts, all the advocates, the families are screaming that everything is not okay. We have a completely oblivious government that is just refusing to take more stringent action. And that's absolutely what is needed. We're all in Irwin Center. I'm exhausted. I've been screaming for 10 months now. I'm tired. I would love if they just listened so I didn't have to talk anymore.
Well, I don't know that they're listening because the problems seem to continue time and time again. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Pat Armstrong. Dr. Armstrong is a distinguished research professor at York University and a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. Doctor, thank you so very much for joining us. Glad you could be with us today.
Thank you for paying attention to this issue.
Well, you've been doing it for a very long time and advocating for it. Just how frustrated are you these days, Doctor?
Well, as you say, we've been saying this for a long time, and in fact, movements to reform long-term care began in the 80s in Canada, or even back farther than that, when the government mandated municipal homes because the for-profits weren't doing a good job at the time. So it's a long history and a long history of neglect.
Well, is it getting any better? Because the evidence I'm seeing right now says no.
No, it's not getting any better, although we have to remember that some homes are doing fairly well, and a lot of that has to do with their staffing levels and the continuity in staff that makes such a huge difference to care. So it's not all homes, but certainly they're all at risk because of community spread, because of lack of communication, because of the fact that none of them have enough staff.
Let me ask you about that, because there's a sense of deja vu here, because we had this discussion back, well, almost a year ago now, during the first wave and the first lockdown, and we were shocked, I think, when we saw the number of cases in long-term care facilities, as I'm sure you were, Doctor. And I had the premier of the program at that time, and of course, as we all know, his mother-in-law is in one of these facilities, I guess in the GTA, and he vowed that, he says, we're going to do something about it, we're going to fix this problem, and all the things you just talked about were some of the driving forces in this. Well, here we are a year later with the second wave, and I don't know that a whole lot's changed.
No, it hasn't. They didn't do very much at all about staffing. They did say that you should only work in one place, but they didn't provide enough full-time work or full-time pay for those people to ensure that that was the case. They didn't do anything about agency staff. They didn't do inspections to ensure that the kinds of testing and training and staffing that was required was in place.
Well, I want to talk to you about that, and I'm glad you brought up the idea about inspections, because that's been a sore point for me is in our discussions about this. The Ministry of Long-Term Care said in a statement earlier this year, and this is a quote from their statement, compliance is assessed through our rigorous inspection program. That's their words, not mine, which ensures that every single long-term care home is inspected at least once a year. And then they say there was a process in place for inspectors to report potential criminal negligence to the appropriate police to determine whether or not investigation is warranted. First of all, the numbers tell quite a different story. Not every facility is being inspected on a regular basis. As a matter of fact, the numbers have gone down considerably, and we brought that to the Premier's attention. He said, we're going to address that. Here we are a year later, and it's no better.
No, I agree. The the inspections haven't been happening in the same way. Now, there is a plan for rigorous inspections, and we could raise questions about what they're inspecting for, because we can always look at those practices too. But we haven't been doing those full inspections in all of the homes, as you said. So, but part of the reason, or part of the problem, I should say, is not just do you do the inspections, but what happens as a result of those inspections. We haven't seen anyone close down. We haven't, before COVID, seen the military called in or hospital or Red Cross called in, and yet there were many of these problems identified before. I mean, they mainly responded to verified complaints as opposed to doing full inspections, so that they're reactive rather than proactive. And of course, many people are afraid to speak out because they think there will be retributions, and that's true of the staff, it's true of the residents, it's true of the families. So it's hard to base a system primarily on complaints, and primarily on complaints that don't make much of a difference in the end.
Well, I believe the number, and I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it was a single digit. I think it was only 6 or 7 inspections were done in facilities last year. The over, what, 600? And I don't mean 6 inspections per facility. I mean 6 right across the province.
Right.
That's horrendous. Because I've heard the same stories that you have. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the anecdotal information that we heard from the independent inquiry that was done on this suggested that, look, there are horrendous things going on in some of these facilities, not all, but in some of them. And from what I'm hearing, the families are afraid to report them because they figure, you know what, if I do, they're not going to answer my mother's call bell anymore, or they'll take their sweet time getting this over and that over. And they're very concerned about the ramifications of what could occur.
Well, and in addition to not inspecting, we don't require verified data from the homes. We rely on their data to tell us about things like staffing levels, and on their documentation to tell us what's been going on in the home. And I'm not sure that we can always trust that. We don't trust most organizations without an accountant looking at their books. Why should we trust the kind of data that is assumed to provide the kind of accountability we need without verification of those data?
Good question. And I'd like to get some answers to it from the ministry, and they don't seem to be forthcoming. I know that they've got their own inquiry and their own panel, which in itself has created quite a few problems and a few concerns, Doctor, as you well know, because there is representation on that panel, on the provincial panel, rather, of course, from private sector ownership. There is nobody representing the frontline workers on that particular panel to give their side of the story, and that's a big piece of the puzzle that seems to be missing.
Yes, and who knows best what's going on in the home other than the staff? Well, and staff and families and the residents are the people who should be the source of the information. And surveys of satisfactions, we have long known those don't tell us much of anything. The way the questions are constructed and the way people respond, very often in terms of satisfaction, when you talk to residents about how, well, you've told me all this, but the satisfaction survey says that things are just fine, they'll say, well, I don't want to get my PSW in trouble because I really like her.
Mm-hmm.
So they aren't an assessment of what's going on to ask people multiple choice questions in a satisfaction survey, which is one of the things that the owners say indicates that they're doing a good job.
Why isn't there a discussion about staffing? I know that they've addressed it, but very superficially, Doctor. And again, that seems to be one of the key things. We just did a segment last week about another report that compared private sector versus publicly owned facilities, and they seem to draw the conclusion in their report that it's even, that, you know, the precarious problems, the number of deaths, et cetera, are just about the same. Now, some people are going to take exception to that, but when I asked about staffing levels, they said, well, that was actually hard for us to quantify because it's different criteria in different parts of the province. And I said, well, that's the problem, isn't it? Is that there is no provincial regulation. There are no provincial standards for this. So you pretty much do what you want. And if that's going to be the way it is, that's a Wild West show. That's not adhering to a certain protocol that we know is going to maintain a certain standard at all of these facilities.
Oh, I agree. We have to. It's pretty easy to set some standards. Worked hours per resident per day of nursing staff, or the number of PSWs and RPNs and RN per resident. Those are pretty easy indicators. We could implement them now, although we're starting to talk about 4 hours, and that 4 hours is so yesterday's number. It was a number started more than a decade ago as the absolute minimum. And since that time, the care required for people in long-term care has increased significantly. So Charlene Harrington, who's an international expert on these questions and was part of our research team, says now we should be talking about at least 6 hours per resident per day. And Ontario's saying, well, in the next 10 years, we might get there in most homes. It's just inadequate. In terms of why, I think one of the answers to that question is this is care for women by women. We don't place much value on old women, and we don't place much value on personal care work that we see as something any woman can do by virtue of being a woman, which, of course, isn't the case. We even recognize now that women have to be taught to breastfeed. Why should we think that they naturally know how to bathe someone who has dementia and is frail and has other kinds of health issues? It's skilled work, but we haven't recognized it as skilled work. And it's very demanding work. When I interviewed a human resource director in Norway who was in charge of a very large long-term care facility there, she'd come from their equivalent of the CBC, and I asked her what surprised her, and she said what surprised me was how very hard these women work. And I asked her what she would do if she was in charge, and she said, if I was in charge of Norway, I'd pay these women what we pay the men who work on the oil rigs, because these women work much harder. And until we recognize that and recognize that you can't bathe someone in this condition in 6 minutes, then we're not going to address the staffing issue.
But every time we bring this up, and it was brought up in the Independent Review, as you know, and it's been talked about a few times now, when they finally get around to talking about it at Queen's Park, they keep kicking this down the road. I mean, the legislation that this government introduced, as you well know, Doctor, basically does set standards, which, and I agree with you, I think they're standards from 20 years ago, so, but that's what they're shooting for. But they say, yeah, we hope to attain that within the next 2 to 3 years. Why? When Quebec wanted to do the same thing and endeavored last spring to say, okay, we need to ramp everything up, they did it in the space of 3 or 4 months. They just said, we're going to pay these people more. We're going to pay them to train them so that they know exactly what they're doing and how to do it. And all of a sudden, their problems haven't gone away, but they're way further down the road than we are.
Yeah, and it takes political will and some commitment of money. The federal government has provided a lot of money, and that's not even getting to the personal support workers that are there now. Paying them more is important, and training a whole new group of staff is really important. And Quebec, as you say, has moved very quickly on this, and BC is moving as well. Mm-hmm. But you also have to change the conditions of work so that when they get there, they can actually survive. I mean, the highest rates of absences due to illness and injury are in healthcare, and in healthcare, the highest rates are in long-term care amongst PSWs. And to get absence and get your sick leave, you really have to be sick. You really have to be injured. And, of course, the heavy workloads plus the speed at which they have to do this work really makes it a dangerous job. And that's leaving out, of course, the threat of COVID.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about that yet. And that's an interesting angle to this as well, though, Doctor, because a lot of the things we're talking about existed long before the pandemic started. The pandemic has really just shone a light and exacerbated what was already a rather precarious situation for a lot of them.
That's absolutely the case. It's not like any of these problems haven't been identified before. COVID, of course, has exaggerated the problems, but we know, for instance, that contracting out services and contracting out work to agency staff is a real problem. It's not just a problem in terms of infections. It's a problem in terms of continuity of care. Who knows the residents? Who knows the other workers in terms of providing that care? Who knows even where to find the PPE if you're going into a place that you haven't worked in before and you're going into a different place the next day? all of those are problems for the agency staff, but also contracting out the services. You contract out the food services, you're bringing another crew of people into the home to provide those that food, and the food is much less appealing in our experience than food that's cooked in the home. We have eaten in all of the homes that we have studied, and we've studied for this particular project 27 over the in six different countries, and there's no question that food cooked on the premises at least tantalizes the appetite, because mm-hmm. you get to smell food. You know, it's no accident they tell you to cook chocolate chip cookies before you want to sell your house. It's because it makes you hungry and makes you think about food, right? Older people need to be tempted to eat, and when it arrives, one whole meal sitting on the plate, including your dessert, and that it's all the same temperature and it all looks the same, and in fact, in many places we had trouble identifying what was on the plate, you aren't going to tempt people to eat. And one of the things the military reports made really obvious was the importance of food. And the same can be said about laundry and clothing. It's the last piece of dignity we have when we go into a long-term care home. And when you can't have your clothes, or your clothes get lost or shrunk or disappear, and or you don't even get dressed in the morning, which is happening increasingly under COVID, then you lose yourself in the process.
Well, which causes a great deal of mental stress, of course, on the patients, on the families of the patients, on the staff as well, that find themselves in these precarious positions too. The only way, I guess, we're going to get any action on this, doctor, is to keep talking about this, and we're going to do that on this program, and I know it's happening right across the country as well. It's a problem that needs to be addressed by governments, and there have to be some standards that have to be set, and as you say, policed and maintained. And you know, I keep hearing, for instance, that, well, you know, the problem with a lot of the privately owned ones is they tend to be some of the older facilities, and they don't have all the infrastructure in place. Well, they should. I mean, I'm not going to say, you know, I'm not against for-profit, but I don't think necessarily for-profit looking after our elderly is necessarily the best thing for us to happen here, because their concern in for-profit organizations is the bottom line. And they're going to look at that bottom line and say, do we really need to spend $300,000 for a new HVAC system here? We can get away with what we've got. Well, that's not the kind of care I want for my loved ones, and I don't think anyone does.
No, I agree. Why didn't they put their profits into improving the facilities? But it also, if you compare them to the municipal homes, a lot of the municipal homes in the city of Toronto, which I have studied, are four bedrooms, and they have had much better outcomes than for-profit homes. At least that's the general pattern. Some, not all of them, but mm-hmm. but some of them certainly have, like Castleview Wychwood, that was there was a Star story about this recently, is a huge complex. It's a tower, and it has mostly four bedrooms, and they have done very well in terms of COVID.
So much more to talk about here, Doctor. We're a little tight for time this morning, but I want to stay in touch with this. I appreciate the great work that you have done for many, many years on this, and we'll certainly stay in touch and keep shaking the cage here until we get some action from the government. Thanks so much for this today.
I will, and thank you for covering this issue so well.
Take care. Dr. Pat Armstrong, of course, from York University.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
As promised, inspectors fanned out this past weekend over the GTHA, targeting big box stores to ensure that they were following COVID-19-related health and safety rules. Global's Tina Trajanti has the details.
50 inspectors made the round Saturday and Sunday and checked in with over 100 stores permitted to keep their doors open during the lockdown. 31 violations were found. The most common were linked to screening of customers and staff, masking protocols, and physical distancing. 11 tickets were issued along with the same number of warnings. Overall, 70% of the retailers were found to be in compliance. Labor Minister Monty McNaughton says this won't be the last blitz. More are coming in an effort to get the virus under control, and they will be expanded to include the whole province and more workplaces, including those in manufacturing and distribution. Those found violating the Occupational Health and Safety Act can be fined up to $100,000, while corporations can be fined up to $1.5 million per charge. Tina Trajani, Global News.
Well, let's talk about the program and how effective it's hopefully going to be over the next little while. And to that end, we're pleased to welcome to the Bill Kelly Show Monty McNaughton, who is the Labor Minister for the Ontario government. Mr. Minister, thank you so much for the time. Glad you could join us today.
Well, Bill, it's great to be on your show this morning, and I hope you have a great week ahead.
Well, we're hoping we have a great couple of weeks ahead and start seeing those numbers go down so we can get back to some sense of normality. But we're in the second wave right now. It's pretty tough. We saw the numbers over the weekend. 70% compliance is the number that I've seen here. But that's not good enough for you, is it?
Not at all. I mean, I think at this point in the pandemic, every business knows exactly what they need to do to keep workers and the public safe. The numbers clearly are going in the wrong direction in terms of overall COVID numbers. So we just need businesses and supervisors and workers to be more vigilant today than at any point during this pandemic.
What are you hearing anecdotally, and what was the motivation for the inspection process? Because I've heard on the program really since about March 15th of last year, during the first lockdown, that there was a lot of concern about non-compliance in some of these facilities. I've only been in a big box store once since then, the Costco out here in Ancaster, and it was back in the summertime when things were kind of, you know, relaxing a little bit. And I was shocked at you know, the number of people that were crowded in there like sardines, especially at the cash register areas. Is that the same sort of story, kind of story that you've been hearing over the last number of months?
Well, look, we're focusing on inspecting any type of workplace that's open during this lockdown period. I launched this big box blitz last Thursday to go into big box stores across the GTHA on Saturday and Sunday. We know that, you know, a lot of people go to these places to shop. We went into 39 big box stores in Hamilton. We did well over 230 inspections overall in the GTHA. The three biggest issues that we found during this inspection blitz this weekend, we saw that the big box stores, some of them weren't complying with the pre-screening measures to, you mm-hmm. know, check symptoms of customers and staff going into the big box stores. There were issues with masking and people following the masking protocols, and as well some issues with physical distancing. But you're right, 72% compliance overall, but it's simply not good enough for me.
Well, when you say the screening process, let's talk a little bit about that, because I mean I've heard that from a lot of folks, and there's a series of questions that you're asking that that should be somebody at the door, obviously, whether it's a grocery store, a big box store, any other store exactly. LCBO, I guess it covers all of these situations here. Are you finding that that the stores themselves are concerned about that, and you know that's one staff person that has to be out there? You know, they're worried about that cost. They're worried about whether or not people are actually paying any attention. How strict are they allowed to be? Because one of the concerns I've heard, Minister, is that, you know, the government's basically asking us to do the enforcement, and we don't have the wherewithal to do that.
Well, look, we put out more than 200 resources for businesses, including big box stores, early on in the pandemic. These businesses and workers can go to ontario.ca/COVID safety. There's checklists to follow. There's posters and tip sheets. I mean, every single thing that businesses need to know. They have to do the pre-screening. Again, they have to be better than they've ever been during this pandemic. We're in the middle of a second wave. The numbers, quite frankly, are frightening, and I expect them to pull up their socks. These big box stores have the resources to do it, and clearly, you know, they're open during this lockdown, and it's my job as minister to protect every single worker that's going into any type of workplace during this pandemic.
Minister, I got to run something else by you, because I've received a lot of feedback about this over the last couple of days after the Premier made the announcement about the lockdown and the parameters for the lockdown. And that had to do with the big box stores, and especially, well, we'll talk about the two that were mentioned more often than not. It was Costco and Walmart, large corporations, and the fact that they're also selling things as well as groceries. I mean, I can go and buy a pair of jeans at a Walmart as well as a can of beans if that's what I want to do. And there's a concern, as you've heard, I'm sure, from some retailers that's saying, look, that's an unfair playing field, that other jurisdictions like Quebec and BC have limited places like that to say you can't sell those products. All you can sell are grocery items. What was the discussion like with your government to make the determination to go this way as opposed to the way that Quebec did, for instance?
Well, look, certainly COVID-19 hasn't been fair to any single person, not only in Ontario, but literally across the world. My viewpoint is, as Minister of Labour, Training and Skills Development, the government came up with an essential business list. Of course, you know, selling groceries and pharmaceutical products is essential. And my job is to keep workers safe going in to any type of job at any point during the week. And you did mention it in the beginning, but we are expanding inspections. We're, you know, going into distribution centers, manufacturing facilities, agri-food businesses like processing plants. I mean, we're literally in every type of business across the province during this 28-day period to keep workers safe and the public at large.
But with that in mind, I guess the concern that I've heard from some small businesses, and I'll go back to the example of clothing, you know, they can go into Walmart and they can buy clothing, yet a small business person who may be on Main Street in small town Ontario, or of course even on Bloor Street in downtown Toronto, isn't allowed to have any shoppers in there right now. It's only curbside and you can't buy clothing like that. And they say, look, that's giving the big box stores a huge advantage over us.
Yeah, look, I come from a small business background myself.
I know, yep.
in a small town. I encourage everyone to go and shop at your local small businesses. Do that curbside pickup. Support them by getting products delivered. We have to do everything we can to support our small businesses. But look, the sooner we get these numbers down, the sooner we can get every business in this province open and get the economy firing on all cylinders again.
And as a small business person, I'm sure you can relate to this because we, in our anecdotal assessment of this as well, we found that small businesses were probably, for the most part, more compliant with the standards you had set than some of the larger stores were. And there was a lot more adherence to that about if it was only going to be three customers or four customers in the store at any one time. Consumers seemed to be okay with that. There was much more enforcement about that. And the question, I guess, that I'm hearing from an awful lot of people is, well, why are you putting these restrictions on smaller businesses when we're the ones that were really playing by the rules?
Well, look, I've certainly said that throughout this pandemic, most businesses have stepped up to put in place the health and safety protocols to prevent COVID-19 from entering the workplace. We're going to continue to go after those bad actors. In fact, five of these big box stores and their corporations had fines issued against them this weekend. There's still a number of investigations going on, but we're going to continue every single day to have literally hundreds of inspectors out. We had just over 50 dedicated to this weekend's blitz, but we'll continue to protect the health and safety of workers and to visit all types of workplaces.
Oh, okay, that's a different twist of this that we had not heretofore understood, that you're going to be doing this all the time. This is not just a weekend occurrence. You're sending inspectors out every day to different places.
Well, we did a targeted blitz this weekend,
sure,
just over 50 inspectors. But keep in mind, we have literally hundreds and hundreds of inspectors across the province going in to workplaces. I do want to make one point clear. Any worker out there is able to refuse unsafe work if they feel that their health and safety is in jeopardy. They can refuse that work. They're protected by law. And I encourage any worker, if they feel unsafe, to call our toll-free number. It's 877-202-0008, and a Ministry of Labour inspector will respond. But again, I just encourage workers and employers to just really work together as best as possible to get through these difficult days.
Good advice, Minister, on that, and I hope people take advantage of that if they feel as if they're in a precarious situation. But would a complaint like that or a series of complaints like that, would that trigger an investigation into that particular facility or an inspection into it?
Absolutely. I mean, we review all of these complaints that come in. Again, you know, a lot of places of work have a joint health and safety committee. I remember in our family business, I started a joint health and safety committee. These committees are really, really important, especially in times like this. Try to resolve that dispute internally within that place of business, but by all means, don't hesitate to call the Ministry of Labour.
And we want people to be aware of that as well. And I want to talk also, if we could, about some of the other programs that your government, in cooperation in some cases with the federal government, have offered financial assistance to an awful lot of people that might find themselves in a situation like this. And I know you heard this, Minister, even dating back to the first lockdown about a year ago now, from some people that were playing in things like grocery stores and things of that nature that we're talking about right now, that were concerned about their exposure and their feeling like this. and there were support programs. Do you see those continuing for a length of time now, as long as this is going on?
Absolutely. Two things. The Prime Minister and Premier Ford signed a deal in the summer. So what the province is doing is we're protecting a job. So anyone out there who's impacted by COVID-19 and self-isolation or quarantine, they can't be fired for that. But the federal government has a sick day program where you can get up to $500 a week if you're at home. Furthermore, the federal government also has a program if a mom or dad are out there in their home because the kids are off school, there's financial support. So we know about 80,000 people in Ontario are participating in the sick day pay and now or have participated in that. So we need all workers to know that these financial supports and the job protected leave is in place now.
When the announcement for the lockdown was made a couple of days ago by the Premier Minister, there was a hue and cry that I know filtered to your office at the Ministry of Labour about paid sick days and that there should be a regulated program. Do you feel that what you have on the books right now is going to be sufficient for that?
Well, look, I've been on the phone for the last week with the federal ministers, encouraging them to ensure that that sick day pay gets out as quickly as possible, because I think that's the boost that workers need. But as I said, 80,000 workers are participating in that federal program. It's administered by the Trudeau government. And again, the provinces are responsible for job-protected leave, and the federal government has the paid sick days. Look, these are obviously unprecedented times. I'm encouraged that the provinces and the federal government have worked together to put financial supports in place for workers. And, of course, it's costing, you know, both levels of government and taxpayers billions and billions of dollars in supports for people.
Let me ask you about that and the cooperation that goes on, too. And you know, having been in politics for a while, Minister, that the relationship between provincial governments and federal governments, no matter what political stripe, can be acrimonious an awful lot of the time. Are you comfortable with the level of cooperation that's been established and hopefully is maintained over this past little while between the federal and provincial government, especially with the Ontario government, obviously in our situation, to make sure that there is an easy transition here from one program to another and that the funding is going to be in place?
Absolutely. I mean, I work closely with my federal colleagues. We know the Premier and the Deputy Prime Minister have a special relationship, but it's so important. I mean, if you look at paid sick days, for example, the federal government has really given Ontario workers over $1 billion in supports. We stepped up with lowering hydro bills during this pandemic and putting out financial checks to moms and dads who have kids at home. I mean, there's been cooperation at both levels of government, and we're both working together really to get assistance out the door to workers and small businesses.
When the Premier announced the lockdown here and the parameters for that lockdown, he mentioned, I think it's about February 11th or 12th, I think it is the date that this is going to expire or could be extended, I guess. What sort of numbers is the government looking for, Minister, to suggest that, okay, maybe we can, you know, relax things a little bit, or as the case might be, extend this program? I mean, is there a certain ballpark that you're looking for here to say that's good, okay, no, we're not, it's not working?
Well, I can't speak to a specific number, but definitely we have to be in much, much, much better, a much better place than we are as of yesterday. Anyways, I haven't seen the numbers for today, but we continue to take advice from the doctors and the Chief Medical Officer of Health, and those are being reviewed on a daily basis. So we'll have more to say, obviously, getting closer to that date.
You talked about the blitz this past weekend, essentially around the Toronto-Hamilton area, the GTHA area, and very successful, obviously, because you've highlighted a number of deficiencies that were in the program. What are the plans for this, extending this to a province-wide basis, or do you feel that's even necessary?
Absolutely. We'll be in big box stores in every community across the province, but we'll also be highlighting and focusing the other initiatives that are happening, including, as I said, you know, distribution centers and factories and agri-food businesses like processing plants. We work with local public health units, local municipalities, to determine which workplaces we need to go in. But we also take concerns heard by the public at large, and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to launch this big box blitz, because we know there are certain workplaces and businesses where people gather, and we want to ensure that businesses are being held to account and that they're keeping people safe.
And obviously, the concentration on the GTHA at this, I think, is understandable. When you look at some of the numbers over the last couple of months, I guess, really, they basically are identified as some of the hotspots in the province. When you look through the GTA, certainly, and Peel and Durham regions, and extending now, as you say, through Halton and into the Hamilton area, it seems to where those numbers are getting higher than they are in other parts of the province, that you would concentrate on them first.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we did that. But I come from southwestern Ontario, and the numbers are growing really in most communities. I think of my riding of Lambton Kent Middlesex, which is between London and Chatham and Sarnia.
Yep.
I mean, every hamlet, every village, every town now has cases of COVID. And of course, we see the situation in Windsor Essex. The numbers are quite high. So it really is a problem facing the majority of this province. And that's why my message to every big box store, to every business out there, just take this seriously. Do more now than you've ever done during this pandemic. We all have to be more vigilant, including managers and supervisors and workers and the public at large. We have to work together to finally defeat COVID-19.
Minister, thank you so much for the time today. I really do appreciate it. It was encouraging to see the number of inspections that were made, and with the anticipation of this being a program that's going to be expanded, hopefully this will be one of the tools that's going to reduce the number of new cases that are coming up. Thanks so much for this.
Thanks, Bill. Take care.
Take care. That's Monty McNaughton, the Labour Minister for the Ontario government, talking about the blitz going on in big box stores and larger stores right now to make sure that there is compliance, because that wasn't necessarily the case, at least from what we've heard anyway.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
I want to get into something that's on a lot of people's minds these days because of, the work that's gone on, for instance, for a vaccine for COVID-19, and this is ongoing. I mean, we can specify that, but there's so many other things happening in medical research these days. But what happens if there's a conflict between medicine and how they affect patients' health and safety and big business? Because let's face it, we've always heard that expression, big pharma, and the impact that it can have and the lobby that it has on politicians. So how much of an impact does that have? And is it putting our health and safety in a precarious position? To talk about this, I want to bring in somebody who's actually been on the program before, who I'm so happy to have back on the program, especially in this time when there's some concern about vaccines and the implications of it. Dr. Nancy Alveri is a physician and a professor of pediatrics and medicine and public health sciences at the University of Toronto. Doctor, great to have you back on the program. Thanks so much for the time today.
Oh, Bill, thank you very much for having me. It's terrific, terrific. I've been listening to your show. I'm so glad you got Pat Armstrong on, and she and her colleagues and all these. I mean, I'm not an expert in long-term care, but Vivian Stamatopoulos and all the long-term care families who are going through this nightmare. I just was so happy you profiled it. I don't know if there's another more important issue right now. Thank you.
Well, they're all intertwined, aren't they? I mean, long-term care,
really
pediatric care, everything. And especially, Doctor, with the work that you're doing. And that's why I wanted to focus on that. I was fascinated by the essay that you did back, I guess it was in December, How John Le Carre Changed My Life. And this,
oh, right.
I got to tell you, Doc, this is a movie script, okay? This is life imitating art, because this very theme that you've talked about here, that Le Carre actually approached you about, I mean, they've made movies and TV shows, written books about it, like Le Carre himself did after the discussions he had with you, and that resulted in actually one of his bestsellers. Well, they were all bestsellers, but The Constant Gardener, I'm sure people have read the book and they say, oh, really? Is that where that came from? Maybe, if you could, before we get into the concerns themselves, maybe a little background on how that happened.
Sure. I was doing a trial in children at SickKids, and things came up, problems with safety and efficacy that I believed I needed to disclose, including to the Research Ethics Board. And the CEO of the company who was partly funding the trials, Bill, said, you're not disclosing, and I'm suing you for all legal remedies if you say anything to patients, parents, or the scientific community. And the difficulty was that at that time, my academic institution, the University of Toronto, were seeking a very large donation. And so combined with the pressure from pharma and the pressure from the academic, I was forced out many times, lost my job several times, got it back several times, spent hundreds of thousands of hours and millions of dollars in terms of defending myself against this finding, which we can discuss in a minute. But it's why I feel like I'm not an expert, but an expert witness in these conflicts of interest. Because when I was going to tell him John le Carré, I said, oh, it probably isn't what you really want to hear. And he said, this is exactly what I don't know. How do they threaten? What do they do? Do they slip a letter under the door? In my case, the CEO slipped a letter under the door and said, you'll be served with all legal remedies if you say anything. Now, it's really dramatic, right, Bill? But this happens a lot. This just doesn't happen. You get threatened and you get into a fictional account. But people are tailoring their findings to funding. There's no question. And so the problem is, you read a study about drug X, and I, as the author, say, oh, I took money. And you think, at least I think, and I'm sure you think, and a lot of public thinks, well, does that really mean that the results are accurately represented? Because did you, even if you do disclose, and I want to say something about disclosure in a minute, mm-hmm. you're still pressured by reporting what the guy wants you to report, or the, it doesn't matter if it's the CEO wants you to report. And do people, you know, do people back down? Of course they back down. They back down all the time and say, well, we'll make it sound another way, or we'll do a subgroup analysis. We'll make the data look more favorable than they are. You know, I'm just one story in many, many stories. In fact, in many, many people who try to do what I did, all over the world, there are stories like this. A lot of those stories are buried.
Well, and therein lies the problem. Yeah, go ahead.
No, and so, you know, and then people say, well, I disclosed it. So you've got a lot of these meetings where people stand up and they show two slides saying, I take money from company A, B, C, D, E, and F. And then they say, well, I'm really open about this. But, you know that most of the studies are funded by pharma. So it's not a real no-brainer to say, of course, I was funded by pharma to do these studies. Disclosure, I'm not saying disclosure isn't important. I mean, it's necessary. Canadians were sold a bill of goods on the opioids would probably have liked to know that some very prominent doctors were getting money to promote those opioids. But it's insufficient. It's insufficient, you know, to say, oh, I just told everybody about that. So, you know, you have an issue where you don't know. That's the problems with conflict of interest. That's why we need to talk about removing pharma or big business from research. But we also have to look at, am I going on too long? Because I don't want to even say solution. I want to say an approach would be, let's say I'd sat down with, and he said, this is not what it shows. And he lined up doctors to say that I was wrong. And what the solution would have been was to say, let's publish all the data. Every single blood test, every single liver iron concentration, let's put them on the web, and then educated doctors, educated public, patients can say, oh, yeah, that did double. That value did double. It was supposed to go the other way. All the data would be, and there's a lot of approaches now to try to get open access to data. And that would prevent the sort of partial interpretations and the sort of twisting of the statistics. And there are a lot of really common examples of this, not just mine. There's a great study published about 10 years ago that showed that you look at the FDA submissions, the Food and Drug Administration looks at these studies, and they had data, but your doctor, Bill, my doctor, doesn't have those data because the studies are selectively published. And in fact, the ones that actually are unfavorable are published as favorable. So our doctors are not trying to deceive us. Then their office is reading the literature, thinking this drug is going to be 90% effective. But in fact, in this case, it was only 50% effective when you looked at all the studies that have been done. This is really affecting patient safety. This is important.
I have to tell you, one of the reasons I wanted to reach out to you today, and I'm so glad you were available to talk to us today, was we were doing a report about, to go back to our initial thing, the long-term care facilities, that basically said that privately run and publicly run are just about the same. The stats are the same. And I looked a little deeper, and I realized that the study is actually sponsored by one of the major private sector long-term care owners here in the province of Ontario. And I'm not casting aspersions on the doctors that did the research, but I'm saying when there's big money involved in this sort of thing, Even the facility in which you're working is going to be influenced by that because they need the money. I mean, governments don't give the money that they should for funding here, so they're looking at corporations to do this. And the question we need to ask ourselves, and you have been asking it, Doctor, is how much influence, if at all, does that money have? And we've heard examples of this time and time and time again, where they say, look, at you know, have you ever heard of a CEO from a major drug company say, boy, I saw your report there, and you really slammed us on this, but I guess it's good that that information gets out there. Of course they're not going to say that. They're going to say, if you keep this up and if you publish this, you know, the check gets bounced. You're not getting the money. That's all there is to it.
Oh, Bill, I couldn't have said it any better. It's just perfect. We've got to immortalize that paragraph, because exactly. And the problem is that you don't know. Absolutely.
Of course not. And the doctors oftentimes don't know.
No, that's true. They don't see all the data. See the point above. So you're absolutely right. You don't know. I don't know. So there's this uncertainty, and there shouldn't be this uncertainty with patient safety, with drug safety, with vaccine safety, with long-term care, whether or not, I agree, we don't know. Because the power of the influence is so great. And the reason maybe John Le Carré was interested in this story is it had gone on for 20 years. It's still going on.
It probably went on for longer than that. I'm still questioning why thalidomide was put on the market. You know, was there studies that showed that there was going to be long-term damage? I don't know, I don't know if we'll ever know.
Oh, I'd love to come back and talk about that. I can only talk for about 4 or 5 hours on that one alone. it was prevented by the FDA and the United States. Well, we can talk about that in another. You're absolutely right, and that's the problem of conflicts of interest. The doubt surrounds us, and we don't trust. And trust, especially in the times of vaccines, is super important. You've got to know, okay, yeah, there were some side effects. Here they are. And people would say, oh, okay, wasn't in a million people, wasn't even in 10%. I get that. But we don't know when it's shrouded in secrecy, when it's shrouded in money. And that's the problem. And you know, there are no aspersions to this particular study. But it probably always is better in research to do things at a very large distance. I'm the person who was taking money from the drug company CEO, but in my case, I can tell you it wasn't easy to declare those problems. And just as you said, there's no CEO who says, thanks for pointing out that I'm going to lose a lot of money when I don't license this drug. There's no university that has ever said, well, we're going to back our researcher on this one. None, never one. People think I'm a big naysayer, and I say, okay, show me an example where the academic institution said, hey, you can't threaten our researcher. There's none.
No, but invariably how this does get resolved, if it ever does, and as you mentioned, it oftentimes doesn't, is through legal action, where somebody actually finds out that, hey, wait a second, this is not, you know, the be-all and end-all that everybody had promised. And I guess one of the better examples of that is OxyContin, that came out as a miracle drug. And, you know, and our listeners know this. I mean, I've had 2 knee replacements, so I'm well-versed in pain and joint replacement and the medications necessary. But nobody talked about the addictive qualities of OxyContin when they sucked this out there, and look at how that has wreaked so much havoc in our society as a result.
100%. It's all involved informed consent, and you can't be informed if anything is hidden. Another example, you know, this is exactly the point, is that legal action will uncover it. But, you know, that's years later after damage has been
done. And expensive.
And expensive, really. I don't want to tell you how many lawyers I had at the height of this fight, but... And, you know, part of the stuff is because people do sue, and then expert witnesses who are inclined, like us, to question these practices are called as expert witnesses, and they realize books written about this, the illusion of evidence-based medicine, because people talk about evidence-based medicine, but the evidence is what the drug companies want us to know, just like opioids.
But the problem here is where do we find a balance on this, Doctor? I don't want our discussion to make people so paranoid that they're not going to take any medications, they're not going to take the COVID vaccine, they're not going to do this. And there are people that are like that, you know, the conspiracy theorists that are saying, they're all into this. And I don't want to suggest that everybody in the pharma world is evil, but it's a factor. And how do you sift through that, and how do you find that balance to say, okay, we need to be skeptical, but at the same time, you know, there could be some merit in this too. I mean, people like yourself, try to find that balance.
It's the 64,000. It really is true, because absolutely, this. I mean, it would be very damaging if people went off their medications, like these studies have been inadequate, or declined to get a much needed vaccine. That would be an important wrong. But I think the only way to do it is to make it more open and to say, you know, yes, this person experienced this side effect, and you did too. Okay, that's two. And lining it up. And people, paradoxically, would be more trusting if they saw what everything that had happened. It's what you don't know that you worry about. And I guess open access, Bill, I think ensuring that when you publish a paper, I just did about a year ago, I published every single item that I referred to in the paper so that people could say, I think you interpreted this wrong. They didn't, but they could have. You know, I think you analyzed this wrong, or the statistical analysis is wrong. That's the way to go, to make these journals open access. Nobody kind of gives you 72.1% of their data. They have to show it all.
Well, and that's the only transparency. I mean, and that's a word that we try to use an awful lot of the time. But, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, if we can get the good, the bad, and the ugly and make up our own decisions, or let our physicians make up their own minds about this as to whether or not it's effective. Because I mean, we could be here until noon today listing, you know, medications like that. Ritalin comes to mind. There's another one. Because they're always characterized when they come on the market as the wonder drug. This is going to solve this problem. And there may well be some verification to that, but at the same time, okay, what are the downsides to it? And do we ever hear that story or the entire story?
Exactly. Okay, so we should stay on until noon and discuss this, Bill. You'll just have to come to the rest of the morning.
I'll try to run it through my boss. I see if we can do this. It's an important discussion, though, Doctor, and that's why I want people to be fully aware of this. That you know, when we see a study, and I know even in this business that I'm in for the last 100 years or so, you know, you get a report from somebody and says, oh, let's talk about this. Do the research and find out where was the report, who funded the report, because oftentimes that can have an influence on what's going on. One of the greater concerns, and this is very much of a companion piece to the discussion you and I just had, is how corporations are slowly but surely moving into university research on a larger scale, whether it's Huawei with a number of universities, or Big Pharma or others, and they're throwing all kinds of money at universities, and it's much needed money, and you have to ask ourselves, okay, is that going to influence the way in which that research is done?
And it does. I think those are the questions to ask. You know, there was a shift in the late 80s, just as I was starting these trials at SickKids, where I was surprised how much corporate respect there was. Of course, the respect is for money. The respect is for, as you say, the cutbacks happened and people, university. I always kind of think, well, you know, we need to think about whether the public would want to be taxed more for honest research. You know, it's difficult because we have to recognize the problem that these things are eroding the evidence base, and they're making things more difficult to interpret, to be sure about drugs. So, you know, you've said it all, really. I mean, it's one of the most important things, if not the most important consideration in research today, is if you're generating research, you want to be doing an honest job, and you can't disclose everything if you're threatened, and you have to face years of threats and lawsuits.
I wish we had more time. I from a literary standpoint, I wanted to ask you how, when you finally read The Constant Gardener, to see Laura's trials and tribulations, to see yourself in a book, that's got to be something kind of special, too.
Oh, I thought I was, I opened it up. I don't want to spoil for anybody who hasn't read it.
No, of course,
I thought
no.
I was this really nice person, but then I was realized that I was the witch with the bee in chapter 18. It was really funny. It was pretty sadly accurate, very sadly accurate.
Well, I'm going to reread it now. You've got me, because it's been years ago since we did this. Always a pleasure to have you on the program. I think, as
you
I mentioned,
too,
in the interest of full disclosure, your father was the greatest pediatrician of all time and practiced in Hamilton for many, many years here. So there's a lot of people that are going to recognize the last name and understand that that excellence runs with the work that that the Oliveris do.
Thank you, Bill, and love to Hamilton. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Nancy. Good talking
with you
again.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Nancy Oliveri, of course, from SickKids, and Professor of Pediatrics and Public Health Science at the University of Toronto.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on 900 CHML.
The Bill Kelly Podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also listen to The Bill Kelly Show weekdays from 9 till noon on 900 CHML. I'm Bill Kelly. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It's free, so you never miss an episode. And make sure that you rate and review.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.